I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. In his new book, the author M.G. Vasanji takes us along in his personal journeys back to India. He was born in Kenya, raised in Tanzania, and has long made Canada his home. His parents weren't born in India either, but his grandparents were, and with this sense of belonging, he went back beginning in the early 1990s and now brings a book that's part travelogue, part history, and part memoir. A Place Within, Rediscovering India, is his first work of nonfiction. The two-time winner of the Giller Prize and countless other awards writes an absorbing, vivid, and fascinating book about the India that he's come to see, travel, and feel, as well as become a part of. The book is published by Doubleday and retails for $34.95. It is a tremendous book. I am very pleased to welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, M.G. Vasanji. Good morning, Mr. Vasanji.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How did you view India before you actually went there in 1993? It was 93, was it?
Yeah. It was more a place of myth and romance. I guess the romance came from partly from Bollywood films in childhood and partly I went to university in the 70s, so it was India of spirituality and all the exoticism that was going around in those days about India. And I suppose there were some stories that I heard about India. It was the kind of mythological birthplace of our people who lived in East Africa. So that was India.
Your parents, had they gone to India after they went to East Africa?
No. My parents were born in East Africa, and obviously, my father, there's a story my mother told me about my father, who was a bit of a vagrant in his youth, trying to go to Bombay. By boat, just getting on a boat, but when he got there, he didn't have papers or money and he was sent back. So he didn't land in India. He saw Bombay from the porthole of a ship. So that's the kind of image I have of an attempt to go back to roots or to just a place where his parents came from.
This might seem like a silly question, but I'll ask it anyway. As a novelist, was it harder to write about yourself?
Well, it was hard to sort of reveal myself. I found that in this book, if I was going to write about how I responded to India and became engaged with it, then it took me a long time to write this book. I finally realized that I have to put more of myself directly in this book, say who I am. So that was one difficulty, realizing that. And secondly, is just the fact that I'm doing a lot of history and research and bringing that all into shape was not as straightforward, because there's a lot of history and you also have to make it interesting. And I think that one of the main problems to begin this book was what voice to give it.
I understand that you're working on a biography of Mordecai Richler.
Yeah, that was my other nonfiction project, but that came later. I mean, by the time I was finishing this book.
You're working on that currently, I gather?
But I finished it.
You finished it?
I finished it last week.
Do you feel like you need to go back to fiction writing? Do you enjoy nonfiction writing?
But I found both these books very important. This one was important because it was, going back to India was for me a momentous visit. I didn't realize how momentous until I actually landed and then sort of almost in a ritualistic way, put my foot on the soil of India. It just was an amazing trip that I could not explain my response to India. So, and then being a writer, my reaction was not to take photographs because I didn't take cameras with me. I just wrote notes. I just wrote about my feelings and my questions and so on. So it was a book that I had to finish. I had to write. For me, it was an important book, basically discovering myself. But it was difficult because I always get this urge to go back to writing a story or begin a novel or even a short story. And I had to I had ideas. I'd written some rough drafts in a panic or some kind of euphoria, one summer a couple of years ago. And I also had ideas for a novel, but I couldn't get down to it. You know, I had to finish this book. And the nitty-gritty of this book was also difficult, you know, sort of, you know, picking up history books or ordering them online. Or a lot of books are not available in libraries here, so I had to, you know, order books and then read them and reread them. And, you know, it's a kind of history that's not told very clearly. You know, there are books that were written maybe 100 years ago, maybe 50 years ago, and then so it was hard. You know, there was nothing clear cut.
We see a lot of memoirs about writers going back to their homeland, and it seems almost a trite exercise in trying to find themselves. Was that something that you wanted to do, or was that something you're trying to avoid?
But you know, most people go by finding. It depends what you mean by finding yourself. Finding oneself is not going back to the home where your grandfather was born, because I couldn't find it. And by the time I reached the town where my great-grandfather was born, it didn't really matter where he came from. It was India. The first trip where I landed in Delhi, which is not my ancestral place, was the momentous one. But the finding oneself is the whole process of writing about it and discovering yourself, why you respond in certain ways. Why is it important, you know, this trip? Or what makes you keep coming back? Because immediately, a year after my first visit, I was back. And I must have gone back 8 times after that, trying to find out more, or find out another place, or it was an obsession. So India became an obsession, which I just could not control and could not understand. I realized that it was so much a part of me. But if it was a part of me, I had to understand why and in what manner. And that's not a trivial thing.
And the India that comes across in the book is colorful and exciting. It's also violent and violent and complicated. Around the time of one of your visits there were a number of riots. They were between whom?
Well, this one was my first trip. There were riots in Bombay and some other cities, and they were between Hindus and Muslims. But basically, Muslims constitute 1/10 of the population. So it's, you know, when you say a riot, sometimes, you know, it doesn't quite give the real picture. So there was violence on both sides, but, you know, it was mostly the Muslims who get the brunt of it because they are in the minority. And therefore, if a mob comes, the chances are, you know, Hindu mob, Muslim mob is not going to last. But on the other hand, to call people Hindus and Muslims, for me, was problematic. Because for me, they were Indians, and they were just some violent elements within who called themselves the Hindus, but, you know, they were just fanatics. And sometimes the violence was politically motivated. But using these labels, and then the labels that came with old grievances going back 1,000 years or more, it was just a mindless kind of violence going on. But officially, and, you know, when you talk to people, it is called Hindus versus Muslims. I didn't quite see it like that. For me, it was more complex, and all my friends in India were Hindus, so I didn't see them as the violent side. They were all agonized, you know, so the whole country agonizes over this outbreaks of violence, which are so mindless, so barbaric, and then they disappear, and then they happen again. Meanwhile, life goes on. It's one of the safest countries to visit, and a friendly place. So it just, that's why, you know, it evoked so many responses. And the thing is not to draw conclusions easily, just to be what you are and observe. Yeah. And observe yourself, I suppose. I think that's the most honest thing I could do, was to see how I responded.
And how did you respond? What were you?
Well, the violence really made me very sad. And I would say it. Although it made other Indians sad too, but I was just, this was something I could never reconcile myself to. I could not say it's happening out there. You see? So, that it was not part of my heritage, you know, because in East Africa we didn't have this kind of violence. It just wasn't there, and I could never come to terms with that.
One of the things that struck me about the book, and I don't know much about India, was that how diverse it is in terms of religion and and just culture in general. Is India a model, do you think, in how we can all coexist with one another?
Well, India is just there, you know. It's not even modeled. I mean, it's a big country. Some people have said it's many countries, you know, because you have different languages, different personalities, depending on what area you come from, which area you visit. But in terms of coexistence, you know, you could definitely have better coexistence, because there is a lot of violence there, you know, when it breaks out. The hatred that has been harbored historically, and the politics there are often very corrupt and manipulative, and they sometimes foment the violence. So it's, I think, not, if you want to take it as a model, I wouldn't.
Is the goal, therefore, and the violence, nationalism for many of these sects, these groups?
It's a kind of mindless nationalism, because, you know, historically, these people don't understand the history of India, like who the Indians are, where they came from, and, you know, what they are they constituted of. So if it is a nationalism, then there's also mythology that is connected with the nationalism. So then that mythology says that the Hindus are all from India, the others are foreigners, whereas historians who are not nationalist or religious-minded will tell you that there have been many migrations into India from all kinds of people in the past. So, you know, that has, all those migrations have contributed to what India is today. So the nationalism is not just saying we are all Indians or Hindus. It's also based on a kind of mindless interpretation of history.
And it comes to this country as well. You write in the book about the irony of immigrants from India who come to Canada, who gain citizenship here, and then who support militant nationalists and fundamentalists back home.
Yeah, my feeling is that I don't think most of it is consciously in support of violence, because not many, you know, decent people, and these are family people, support violence as such. But they would be taken in by some cause back home, which talks about old values and old histories and, you know, threats from terrorism and threats from these others and so on. And they would give money, you know, essentially, why immigrants send money back home is nostalgia. So they will send money to nationalist groups who, you know, nationalism, and when nationalism is linked with religion, so-called, then you can play on people's guilt feelings and nostalgia, and then the money goes back. So you found that the chief minister of Gujarat, for example, where the most violence occurred, and he was condemned by the Human Rights Commission of India. And based on that, the U.S. refused him a visa to enter the United States. Well, the Indian groups here sort of were very angry at this. They wanted him to come here. So you can see that there is a nostalgia that goes against what the, you know, human rights bodies in India themselves have concluded. So it's and I know some of these people who do that, and they're decent people in many ways. It's a very complex. People sometimes can compartmentalize different parts of their of their beliefs and their behavior. So, you know, the patriotism towards India and feelings of nostalgia towards how life was, nice life was back home, is compartmentalized, you know, it belongs to a different part of you than the violence that happened 3-4 years ago, where, you know, a few thousand people died and the worst kind of rape and butchery occurred. So you don't question that. That's a bit disturbing. I think it will take a generation, maybe a new generation of people who sort of don't go in for that. One thing I also observed, but at least the young people here in the United States, many of them don't go in for. Some of them, of course, do. Young people always, you know, sort of get into the nostalgia bit. But there are many who just, for them, it doesn't really matter, you know. And for those people, there's a lot of meeting across religious, ethnic, communal lines. I can see that. So hopefully that's where the hope, you know, the hope lies for greater peace.
You spend a great deal of the book talking about the spiritual nature of India, discussing the legends of gods and so on, taking us to some of those places where these legends occurred and so on. How spiritual are you?
I'm not. I was brought up in a kind of spiritual religious background, so I have a sensibility. I explore some of that in my last novel, so I have the sensibility. I cannot condemn or sort of sneer at people who have beliefs primarily because I can see my own parents in that. When I see a woman praying before a god or, you know, someone bowed in prayer in the mosque, I can see my elders doing that. So I cannot sneer at them. But I personally don't pray to any particular thing. But spirituality is in a sense also like poetry, you know, where somehow you address the mystery of existence. You don't have to bow down or sort of join your hands or try to convert other people to some, or believe in a prophet. You know, you can have a sensitivity to the mystery of existence and the beauty of it and I suppose sometimes the horror of it. But in that sense, I have a spiritual sense, you know, sensibility. So when I went to some of these temples, and it was just the idea of people going to worship an image. But of course, an image can mean anything. It can mean some people interpret the image as embodiment of a historical god. And for some, it's an element, it's an attribute. So I think there's a beauty there. And of course, sometimes when I would go to these goddess temples, which always are on top of a hill, it's a long climb is involved. When you watch the mood of the people, it's so festive. Like it's the only great thing they have in their life. You know, go once a weekend or, you know, once a month or on a big day. It's just big thousands of people pouring forth, climbing up, eating samosas on the way.
Yeah. And the one great thing about the book, another great thing about the book, I should say, is your discussion of the food there.
Yeah, I mean, Indians sometimes do things just for the sake of the food, I think.
Yeah. Traveling by train, you did a lot of that. Is that primarily the mode of transportation to get around India?
Well, trains go everywhere in India. So you don't need to fly. You can take a train, and now, of course, it's even with internet, it's easier to book a train. A lot of middle classes nowadays, of course, prefer to fly because that's the in thing to do. But I find that that's the most boring and pretentious form of travel. Sometimes you have to do it for the sake of time, but you just meet middle-class people, you know, having coffee in plastic or paper cups and, you know, thinking it's cool. You know, that kind of, whereas in a train, it's really the elements, you know, slow pace of life, you know, that the train goes behind the back of a city and you see the writings on the wall, and then you sit around with people. Each, you know, either they talk to each other or they're private, and you get your Indian food there. You know, it comes, and you go to sleep on a bunk. It's existing at a more, for me, elemental level. It's discomforting. If there's a rain and the train's, you know, sort of delayed, and I've had some of these experiences. Everything works out at the end, but. And especially if you don't live in India, some of these experiences seem very horrific when they're happening, but I've survived.
Is it a costly proposition to travel India, in your experience?
Not by train. The trains are very cheap.
But in general, these trips that you've taken over the years,
the flights from here are not expensive, you know, when you go to a travel agent who specializes in India. And then India is one place where hotels, you can get decent hotels that are not very expensive. And the food, you can get decent food that is not expensive. As long as it is cooked, then it's safe. You don't eat cold stuff. You're just careful eating meat. know, you have to eat meat at a place that really specializes in meat. You know? Otherwise, you don't eat meat, and that's period. I thought that's the safest. But if you have a craving for meat, you can go to a 5-star hotel and have your hamburger. You know?
Yeah.
That's safe. Or one of those places that specialize in, you know, kebabs and so on. But I think it can be. You know, it's not as expensive as going to, even going to Africa, where, you know, you try to get decent food, you have to pay a lot of money.
And the influence of the West on India's culture, you discuss that in the book, the West's influence in terms of technology, even commerce, popular culture. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think one cannot sort of keep back, you know, sort of the progress, you know, at least whatever one thinks of progress, it is a one-way thing, you know, where you have a more Western style of living, where you have more privacy, where you know, things are more comfortable, people, at least the middle class, make more money, and you cannot say, okay, let's go to a simple life, like Gandhi said. Doesn't work. On the other hand, there are things that you lose, you know, the intimacy or connectedness of family life, the spirituality. I found that in India, especially North India, anyone above the age of 50 could easily pose and recite a poem. You know, that sense of poetry and song is in the older India is such so much a part of it. And I don't know how much the younger generation would have that, especially if they live busy lives and, you know, work 14 hours a day and make a ton of money and then go and spend it. So that, but that's middle class life, upper middle class. How much it percolates down, I don't know. But yeah, the spirituality can be lost. But I've had some wonderful moments where just a friend of mine would just recite a poem, a spiritual poem. Just like that, you know, when you're discussing something, and then you see tears in his eyes because it's such an emotional moment. Now, those moments, you know, I live for, but of course, they don't wait for us.
Right. How is your work received in India, your novels in particular?
They received well, but the last one, which was set in India, you know, The Assassin's Song, was received extremely well. Because it also dealt with this communal strife and, people, you know, because essentially North India, everyone has a memory of life, you know, even despite the violence, where people worshipped at each other's places, and, you know, the fact that both faiths, Islam and Hinduism, and Sikhism, this is the third one, came together. Even now, you go to many shrines and you see people of all faiths worshipping a saint or a holy man. So, you know, that awareness is very much there in spite of the recent tension. So when my book came out, it somehow highlighted that, and people were delighted to discuss that. So when it was launched, there was in fact launched with a Sufi recital, and a lot of people came, and it was quite wonderful. So that I was, you know, I was sort of a bit, not scared, but kind of apprehensive about how that book would do, because it dealt with this sensitive subject, but it did very well. This book is coming out in March in India, so I'm sort of curious. The last one was also shortlisted for an Indian prize, so it did well.
And you're going to India in March, are you?
I'll go for the launch, and I am curious how it will be received. I think it should be received all right, but you never know.
And when does the Rishler book come out?
That comes out in spring, but I think a little bit, as soon as I come back from India, it will be launched.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on again, and thank you for taking the time to come on, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you.
It is a remarkable book. It's called The Place Within, Rediscovering India. The author, M.G. Vasanji, here on the Plant Online program, $34.95. From Doubleday for the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.